after Shallan was done and she was still on the stand and she was crying. Bill Cosby was laughing. We were watching him and he was laughing.
Right after CNN, I was doing Kiss FM. I was doing the morning show. Bill Cosby had called in to promote a gig I think he was having in Connecticut or Pennsylvania. And I was like, Bill don't like me, and I don't particularly care for him. So I'm not going to, you know, I'll let you guys do the interview. It's for pre-tape. And so a girl named Jackie Reed and a cat named Steve Wilson, who were my co-hosts, started interviewing me. But he was such a dick. For 5 minutes, he's been such a dick. I was like, Mr. Cosby, what is it you like for us to know? He said, who is this? I said, this is D.L. Hughley. D.L. Hughley, you say nigga, and I don't like your comedy. And he went in, and I was like, with all due respect, Mr. Cosby, I say nigga, but no co-ed has ever woke up drug with her drawers on backwards. And we go back and forth and back and forth. I said, I respect, you could be my son. I said, but I'm not. And I said, everything you are because of your experiences, and I appreciate that, but you're not going to denigrate what I've been through. And I said, no one has ever, out of all the words people have ever said to me, no one's ever said rape. No one's ever said it. We had this argument, right? And so I worked at Kiss FM was owned by Emmis. Bill Cosby, like, that tape will never air. This is a true story. He said, that tape is not going to air. And I said, the fuck it ain't. And 10 minutes later, all the people from Emmis came down, Emmis Communications, took the tape, asked, made sure nobody had a copy of it, said if this airs, nobody in here will work in radio again. So I know that that cat had the power to make people do shit like that.
This was 2009, right?
2009.
So this is way before Hannibal Buress.
But even before that, even if you read Time and Newsweek, in the very back of the paper, it talked about all these rape allegations. I grew up in L.A. and did warm up for a lot of those shows. Everybody knew it. Everybody knew it. Like, Cliff Huxtable is innocent. But Bill Cosby fucked every one of them girls.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I am Lisa Zimbetti. I am the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. And with us today, once again, is...
Nikki Wisensee Egan. I'm author of the book Chasing Cosby, host and an executive producer of the podcast Chasing Cosby, and an award-winning investigative journalist.
And we're so happy to have you back, Nikki, because we had so many other questions, not just of the podcast, but also of your incredible book, which I really do urge all of our listeners, listen to the podcast and read Nikki's book, because it is phenomenal. So many incredible resources in there and sources of information. You can look at the transcripts from the trial, and there's lots of video footage on Nikki's website too.
And so we are going to jump right back into our conversation with Nikki about her amazing podcast called Chasing Cosby.
Well, he had 7 lawyers, as you've highlighted, and teams before that. And again, when we've seen miscarriages of justice, normally someone has a public defender. So we mustn't forget he had a fair crack of the whip, more so than anybody else has. He had Mesereau, who was Michael Jackson's former lawyer, right, who got him acquitted.
It's just, and like, I just there's only 5 lawyers in, like, the
right?
rounds of all these people.
They all get recycled. But in this case, Mesereau couldn't help because there was clear evidence, and he attacked, didn't he, Nikki, the Me Too movement and each victim. And I think that's in court what we tend to see. But the jurors were wincing. And this is what he said. He says, it's a very, very serious moment where an 80-year-old man who's legally blind and had a very successful career is looking at ruin, absolute ruin. I mean, just absolute bullshit, more like. The way that these narratives get twisted and how victims come under attack. It's exactly what Donna Ricciuno tried to do with Weinstein. Even days before sentencing, she was still going to the media and said on Sky News that this is men who now have lost the power and women taking the power. And this is a man who has remarkable achievements and has achieved remarkable things. And this whole legacy bullshit where I'm sure Peter Sutcliffe was an okay lorry driver and Harold Shipman an okay doctor, but these legacies that I think it's a major, major problem. And Weinstein still being reported on as a disgraced producer or a disgraced Emmy-winning media mogul. Well, he's actually a convicted rapist. So why aren't we using these terms? Because we should be, shouldn't we?
And Bill Cosby, every time he makes a statement, it's headlines everywhere. Whatever he says, you know, you get a headline and a whole story about whatever, you know, Andrew Wyatt puts out on social media that Bill Cosby said, or he does that interview and, you know, it gets reported everywhere where he says this was consensual and I will never express remorse. And he still controls the microphone.
And Lisa, you're absolutely right about this recycling of these lawyers. I mean, Mesereau did exactly the same thing with Michael Jackson. And when I interviewed him, I mean, he was talking about all these great things that Michael Jackson did and all these people that he helped, all these kids that he helped and all this bullshit that has nothing to do with the criminal behavior. And if you want to focus on just the good things that people do, why do we even have criminal laws? I mean, why do we say we're a society that protects victims from violence and sexual violence when in fact we look at what defendants do more to mitigate that negative behavior, that horrible thing that they did. Well, but they also did these good things. It's just, it's wrong. And like Lisa Bloom, who was scheming with Harvey Weinstein on how to undermine the credibility of very credible witnesses, how to destroy them so that he would win. And then she's trying to hold herself out as this champion for women's rights and victims' rights. I mean, what the fuck?
Well, not just that, Jim, there was a piece in the news that her and Gloria Allred did. It was a Telegraph who said that these are the two women responsible for bringing down Weinstein, which I tweeted about it. It just, what utter bullshit. Lisa Bloom was on his payroll and tried to take the victims down. Gloria Allred gave the victims a platform in some of these cases, but was not the lawyer responsible. I mean, let's have a bloody reality check. For goodness sake, the women, the survivors, the victims, they are the ones responsible. They're the ones who put everything on the line to tell the truth. And for Andrea, she didn't just do it once. She had to testify twice in court.
And
heartbreaking.
And we were talking in court. You know, I was sitting with Diana Moskovitz, who was covering it for Jezebel. And we were like, these tactics they're using, you wonder how they're going to play with a Montgomery County jury, right? It works when you're up against the LAPD. Because, well, the LAPD has had some issues. But this is a Montgomery County, suburban Philadelphia. It's a wealthy jurisdiction. And also, it logically, it didn't even make sense. Because if Andrea was out for money, she got her money in 2006. That's when she got her settlement. So why is she here? For not one trial, but two. Because it's so much fun to be called a con artist in headlines all over the world. It just wasn't even a logical strategy, but that's what they were using. And you know, there were two female attorneys too, who did a lot of the heavy lifting and a lot of the real female bashing. And I was actually surprised that Mesereau himself cross-examined Andrea, because during the first trial, they had the female defense attorney do it, Angela Agrusa. They didn't have Brian McMonagle do it. They had a female do it. She was horrible, by the way. And that's one of the ones where I was just, when they were saying, making a lot about the fact there were 53 phone calls between them after Cosby and Andrea after this happened. And well, I mean, he was on the board of trustees for Temple. She still worked for Temple. She had to return his calls. And that's when I started drawing these comparisons between that and the Anita Hill hearings. Cause I felt like I was in 1991 again, because it was like no time had passed. Why are you still talking to this man? I mean, it was a work situation. She had to still be in touch with him. She could not ignore a phone call from the board of trustees, someone on the board of trustees from her employer.
Right.
And they tried to make a big deal saying, oh, the one was on Valentine's Day. So for the retrial, they were able to point out there was Andrea worked for the women's basketball team for Temple, and there was a women's basketball game that day. And he had called her about something to do with the team. But, you know.
Part of that, though, is the course of control. Part of that is the grooming has been set and the crime has been done. And he wants to make sure he still controls her. And using his position, he enforces that silence that he had over her for many years. It's part of his MO. It's a part of the crime. So it shouldn't be looked at as something bad that she did. It should be further evidence that cross-corroborates. Why would he
keep doing this? Why is he so interested in her? It shows his obsession.
Right. And you're right. He doesn't care about her or anything about her. If anything, he's trying to still control her, but also maybe to keep covering up his crime and keep showing people there was still contact. Because another thing I talk about in the book that it's not in the podcast is the idea that some of these women, could someone have died after being drugged by him?
That was what I thought too.
Yeah. I mean, think about it. Like, you don't know what other drugs this person might, what else this person might have in their system, or if this would contraindicate with something like that. You don't know that they're not allergic to it. I found out I was allergic to Demerol through getting hand surgery and then breaking out in hives. And if they had not given me the antidote, I would have died. And then there's also the fact that some of these women drove after he drugged them. And like Tamara Green, that's why she slept it off at an all night. So she dinged a car and she's like, I can't drive. And Becky Cooper, the masseuse, who last thing she remembers is her massage table carrying it. And she wakes up in her own bed 2 days later. She drove. Her roommates found her passed out in her car. She didn't know how she got there. They put her in her bed. They kept checking her for 2 days to make sure she was breathing. You know, could someone have gotten in a car accident after being drugged by him and died?
Yeah, or overdose. Some of these women were probably small women and they get a huge, powerful horse tranquilizer. How does he know they're not going to, overdose? It's just so crazy. He could have easily killed people.
I know. And you'd have seen Becky's took one sip of that. Took like a, she thought it was Stoli or whatever she thought it was, and she drank it down. And that was it. And she was out for 2 days. So what was in that drug?
Right. So, and he had no idea how much of it they would drink. And many of these women report feeling it immediately after they took one or two sips, and then they didn't drink anymore, yet they were completely incapacitated. What would it have done if they kept drinking? It shows, again, what you were saying, Laura, that callous disregard for the victims.
He had no care.
He had the power to cover that up. They would have looked like a regular overdose death or just a car accident. And just like there was no mention of Bill Cosby's name in that police report filed against him in New York in 2000 against the teenager that accused him of assaulting her. I bet you money his name would never appear anywhere on any kind of official document.
Hmm. And Nikki, did you write a paper on drug-facilitated sexual assault?
Yeah, I did an expose on them in, I think it was 2003 in Philly. I used to go to CompStat every week because I covered cops, and Timony came here and started that. And I looked for patterns to write about. And they talked about a spike in them at the Delaware Avenue clubs in Philly. And I was so horrified because somehow I'd missed all the coverage in the 90s about where it was happening elsewhere. And not too long ago, I'd been one of those 20-something women, you know, dancing the night away at the nightclubs. So I wanted to do an expose about it. And I did a cover story about it and spoke to a woman who'd been drugged down there. Someone put ketamine in her drink. And she just, and luckily nothing happened to her, but she was completely spaced out. Like she went to go dance, came back, drank her drink. And then next thing she knows, she's like, so yeah, that's when I truly found out how horrific.
It's still happening. I mean,
It's worse than ever.
My friends was out just a few weeks ago and she got drugged and luckily there were friends around that helped her, but it was really bad. And this is a place where she has been many times and thought it was sort of a safe place. And this is in Los Angeles. And we have to be incredibly careful because these people are out there. It's not just Cosby. There are thousands and thousands of people using these kinds of drugs to take advantage of women.
There are. It happened to one of my friends, a female journalist, just a few weeks ago. She's a female journalist who writes on these issues. And she said to me that when she went, she asked the taxi driver to take her to the hospital and they just thought she was a drunk woman and just wouldn't believe what she was saying. And she just had to sit there for ages. And of course, if you don't test someone, it can leave your system very quickly. So now she's taking an interest in this area. And of course, we're covering the Cosby case and New Scotland Yard. I worked on many cases that we believed was drug assisted or drug facilitated. But of course, with some, you don't know what's happened. And when you think something's happened, you disclose too late for it to be tested and confirmed. And serial predators know this. They really do. The irony is we tell people, watch your drinks, don't leave your drinks. And then when they do report, we don't believe them.
Right.
That's got to change.
Right. And that's what horrified me. I was like, it's the perfect crime. And in my view, it's premeditated rape. because it takes away your ability to resist, your ability to speak, your memory in most cases. So there's no sense of resistance. Not that should matter anyway, but we all know it does. And even if you wake up and go to the hospital the next morning, the drug could already be out of your system. And if it is still in your system, even that the perpetrator could say it was consensual. And if it's someone you know, especially, and if the person you're accusing is America's dad,
right?
You think they're going to believe you over him? You know,
that, or you're seen dancing with the person before you leave the bar or the club. It's just right. Terrifying. And I think even I want to ask you just about court at the closing arguments, because I mentioned a quote from Mesereau, but wasn't it Faden who said that Cosby was the con man, not Andrea? She was the one that it kept painting. And as she was saying it, Cosby started laughing and she turned and she laid into him.
She flew across the room.
Can you tell us about that moment and just what you were thinking seeing this happen?
Yeah, it was like there were two big moments in like each of those in the conviction, after his conviction and this one. Yeah, she was so, she and Stu shared the closing arguments, and once they heard their closing arguments, they were rewriting theirs. And they wanted to respond to everything that Cosby's attorney said about the women in it. So yeah, she was calling Cosby the con artist, and then she started defending the women because they had attacked each of the women who testified in their closing arguments. And she looks over and she sees Cosby smile and then start laughing. And she literally flew across the courtroom, got in his face, and she said, "There's nothing funny about this. There's nothing funny about drugging and this, you know, assaulting women and all this." And it was an incredible moment.
That's great.
And after the conviction, when I don't know if I talked about this, when Kevin Steele was trying to get the judge to revoke Cosby's bail, because there had been testimony that Cosby had a private plane, which apparently he doesn't any longer. So he said, you know, he has a private plane. And all of a sudden, Cosby just yells, "He doesn't have an airplane, you asshole. I'm sick of that guy." And it was one of those, like, the mask slipped for the first time you saw the true Bill Cosby.
In cross-examination, the defense team tried to highlight that the motivation behind these women stepping forward at this time was both money and media attention. But the prosecution, Errol, they claim that the testimony from these three women can only help Andrea Constand, and in fact will prove that Mr. Cosby is a serial abuser.
And the other powerful moment at the closing arguments was when Kristen did an apology to Andrea for the way their office treated her in 2005. And I get emotional thinking about it because it was really powerful. Like, none of the people involved in the current case had been part of that in 2005. That was Bruce Castor and his people. So they didn't have anything to apologize for. But Kristen just felt like they needed to apologize on behalf of their office for the way she was treated in 2005, which was, you know, so, so powerful, I thought. To me, anyway, who's been covering since then.
It gave me goosebumps.
I was sitting there thinking the same thing, you know, because I'm just like, oh my. I mean, I think that's one of the things that kept me on this story so long. It was just so outrageous, the behavior, for a woman who'd done nothing except go to the police.
And for you, who did nothing but try to tell the truth, you got attacked and made fun of and ridiculed in public by your colleagues. Outrageous behavior.
We so need these investigative reporters, right, Jim and Laura? I mean, without them, there is no expose of Epstein. We need you so much, as much as we come down on that Inquirer. Without your dogged, determined reporting year after year, decade after decade, we don't catch these people. I mean,
especially when you're talking about people who are engaged actively as professionals in the media, because they know how to manipulate it. They know how to use it, and they have the power. Cosby and Weinstein, perfect examples. They know that if they trade up, they can get a story quashed. They know that if they threaten, they can destroy careers. And that is something that we have to be cognizant of, and that should be an additional crime that is thrown on top of them. I mean, Weinstein and Cosby both did this, and I believe they should be
prosecuted and convicted for doing the same thing.
And Ronan Farrow, you know, he wrote his own mea culpa a few months after this broke because he backed off the Cosby story too. He was interviewing his biographer about, and who did not put the sexual assault allegations in the book that had just come out. And he was told by NBC not to ask him about that, not to bring up the sexual assaults. So he did, and he shoved it in at the very last moment. And he, you know, said he was ashamed of that interview. And maybe that's what made him so dogged on Weinstein, because he felt so bad about that. And he truly, like, what he went through. And it made me wonder, were the reporters trying to report on Epstein back in 2006 and 2005 and 2007 that faced the same obstacles I did? We just haven't heard from them.
Vicky Ward, we heard from, who was trying to report it, wasn't she? And it got shut down by Graydon Carter for Vanity Fair. She has gone on and obviously talked more and more about that. But yes, she did want to tell the true story, but he traded up. Epstein appeared at the offices of Vanity Fair to see Carter. And after that meeting, she was told to drop out of the story. The women, the Farmer sisters who had reported him for sexual assault and rape. So I think a lot of times people do get silenced. The trader up goes on. I don't know what Vanity Fair got out of that. I don't know what he got out of that, but there was clearly something.
Right. I guess I was meaning more local reporters too, like the ones who were in Palm Beach or whatever, where all this was happening. You know, it's a hard thing to overcome when it's an investigation like that. Don't get me wrong. I found that out. But it just made me wonder if there was a reporter back then trying to cover it and just was shut down over and over and threatened, because news organizations to this day are still scared to run things about Cosby.
Do you know the D.L. Hughley story that he tells quite often?
Yes.
Do you want me to tell it or do you want
Go
to
ahead.
Tell it? So D.L. Hughley, who's a very famous comedian and television star. So he had a talk radio show in 2009 for Kiss FM. And he didn't get along much with Cosby, but Cosby called in to do a pre-taped interview, you know, promoting some appearances. And Cosby apparently was really rude, and he used to get down a lot on other Black comedians for using the N-word or using a lot of profanity. And finally, DL just had to respond to him. And he says, yeah, you know, I may use the N-word, but no co-ed has ever woke up drugged with her drawers on backwards. No one's ever accused me of rape, right? So, you know, that interview went down the tubes. And right after the interview, some people from the radio station came down and took the tape and said, you can never talk about this. This is never going to air, or you're never going to work again. That's a lot of power right there to be able to demand that kind of silence.
Well, have you seen the Associated Press interview with him in 2014 after this broke? And you can watch it online. It is him. They're interviewing him and Camille. It's supposed to be about the African-American art parts that they're given to the Smithsonian. They're learning Smithsonian. And they start asking him about the sexual assault allegations. And he does this whole thing. I thought the AP knew better than to do this. I thought the AP, and he says, and I'm going to call so-and-so in LA. They know. And it's this whole thing. You can watch it online. The AP did not release that interview, that video, for 2 weeks after that.
Yeah.
And then when it became clear that the scandal wasn't dying down, Joan Tarsius came forward, some new accusers started coming forward, then they released it. But it's all, and it's in my book too, but it's all about him intimidating them into not running, not releasing their questions of him. When Scott Simon from NPR had just interviewed him earlier that same day and released it that same day, like, he started talking about it. Cosby wouldn't answer anything, but he still talked about it.
Right.
I mean, as recently as 2014, he had that kind of power.
Wow. I mean, yeah, still goes on. Like you said, he makes a statement, or Andrew Wyatt, or they post something on Instagram and everyone reads it and reposts it. You mentioned about Epstein to Julie Brown, who we've quoted many times on the Epstein case, because for the Miami Herald, she did break the story and she's continued doggedly for many, many years. So it harks back to what Lisa said. I mean, it does take a huge amount of steel cojones to run these stories and to know that you've got the truth on your side. But of course, there's so much power play from behind the scenes. And these powerful men we see have tried to control the narrative time and time again. And even the people that have been tweeting us, there's a couple of people on our Twitter timeline, one in particular who keeps saying, Andrea's a liar. She just wanted to get money. It was all about her. taking down a celebrity. She told everything this individual quotes is all inaccurate. But obviously they get all of this from what's been in the media prior, and even the word accuser. And I still bristle, Nikki. I know you've used it, but I bristle every time I hear that word accuser, because it came from Sunshine Sachs of Michael Jackson's case, that suddenly we're hearing women being called accusers by the media. Whereas burglars, when you have your house burgled, you're not called an accuser, you're called a victim of crime. And in all police records, you'll see victim of crime. But yet the language, everything, the spin, the narrative, makes it so hard for women to come forward. And I'm talking about women particularly here in the cases we're mentioning. But I just want to give the rape stats. Out of 1,000 rapes, 995 perpetrators walk free. Just think about that. Out of 1,000 rapes, 995 perpetrators walk free.
That's outrageous. Where is that, and Laura?
So that's a RAIN statistic. And out of 1,000, only 310 cases are reported. So whatever we see is just the tip. You know, it really is. We know that only between 2 and 10% are false allegations. So why do we keep saying that people are accusers or casting dispersions or character assassinating them? And I think Tamara Green said it best. And your live, at the live event that Jim and I sat in the audience and were mesmerized by, when Tamara Green said, you report a burglary, you don't have to be the perfect, most loved person with a squeaky, clean background. So why do we expect the same for victims of sexual assault?
I agree. You know, I agree. I know that advocates hate the word accuser as well. I think journalism has got to figure out a term that works. It's like with pro-choice and pro-life. And I had to do it with death with dignity. There's assisted dying and, you know, assisted suicide. I think with this, you know, a victim, if there are criminal charges, they're legally a victim, right? So I think you could use that, but then some don't like to be called victims. So, but if you call them survivors, are you taken aside? So I think, and the accuser's thing has become the fallback, well, that if they're not an official victim themselves, it's a hard decision. And I see both sides of it. And I think that journalism organizations have to develop their own standards for what term they use, because it does set people on edge.
But at the very least, what you said the other day, Laura, is, when you have a conviction, you can definitely call them crime victims, but you can also say that they survived a sexual assault. I mean, there's no reason to just say we want to lump people in one category. I mean, you can actually describe what happened. And once somebody has testified in a criminal trial and the jury has convicted that person, you should never call them an accuser again. Because
they've obviously,
but you know, people, I'm not talking about you, Nikki, I'm talking about people in the public and people on the defense team. They're still trying to call them accusers when in fact their testimony resulted in convictions because they were actually victims of a crime.
Yeah. And that's the important part, because even Donna Ricciuno doesn't accept the victim, doesn't accept the outcome. And of course, there's an appeal coming in the Weinstein case, but she did say, they have to give evidence in court. It has to be proven. Well, the victims have done that now, and it has been proven. And she seems to forget that we've gone through due process. And of course, there will be an appeal. But her wheeling out his so-called remarkable achievements just the day before sentencing really stuck in my throat.
Is Bill Cosby exaggerating his blindness? The talk co-host Sharon Osbourne sure thinks so.
He's going to play the illness card. Mm-hmm. I think he's already building up to it. He looked very shaky. He tripped. He will never go to jail. He's going to be sick, sick,
even
sick.
His attorney was sure to mention his disability in interviews.
He's 78 years old and blind, so he does use a cane so that he can know what's coming in front of him.
But look at this video from last May, just 7 months ago. Cosby appearing at a school in Alabama. No cane.
I just wanted to ask you also, Nikki, just about what I call poor me syndrome and Cosby with his cane that suddenly appeared as soon as he was arrested and charged. What can you tell us about that and just seeing him in court and the way that he was moving or interacting with his lawyers?
Yeah, it was interesting. He all of a sudden, as soon as he's turning himself in, he's got black sunglasses, wearing them like he's blind, and the cane. Oh. And I have to say, in the 2.5 years I covered, you know, all the court proceedings, I don't think I ever saw that cane touch the ground.
Wow.
We used to joke it was like a vaudeville cane. You know, it was a prop. But
a bit like, yes, the walker, a bit like the walker, yes, that every doctor, exactly, nurse wrote to me saying he's using it completely incorrectly, right. Weinstein, he's going to do himself an injury, right, the way he's using it.
Right. Really? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Cosby had been on tour and he wasn't using, you know, a cane or those black sunglasses. And even in his own bio, he talks about the one issue with his one eye he had that had been mostly corrected by surgery. And I'm told that and they have evaluated him in prison and have determined that he's not blind, but you know, that has not, you know, made its way into the
really.
Yeah.
That's, well, you know, his lawyer said he's legally blind.
He's not, but he never provided documentation for that. And they have even, you know, evaluated him in prison. The victim advocate for the state told me, and he's not, but yeah, it's the poor me. And, you know, he thought the fact that he was 82 would, was he 82 then, 81 or whatever, would give him some cover. And, you know, it's just to create sympathy among his fans. And he still has a million followers on Twitter.
What about his continued performances? I mean, he's been out there, right? He was out there right until he was arrested. If he was legally blind, why wouldn't somebody have to lead him onto the stage? Why wouldn't somebody have to hold his hand to get him off the stage? Why wouldn't he need a cane? Because it's only convenient.
Right. Right. No, I know. And, you know, the visuals say it all. You know, he wanted those visuals. He is a masterful actor. You have got to give him credit for that. He have all, it's all fooled for many years. It's interesting. Whenever I meet people who have actually met him, you know, they all have some kind of story about, like, wow, he's not a nice guy. So, but on TV, he certainly appeared like one.
That doesn't surprise me at all. This poor me syndrome that comes in at the point of accountability. I've seen it across so many cases. I've got one image of Cosby. He's wearing like a granddad sweater and he's got the cane, he's got the glasses on. And, you know, just months before, he's walking around quite happily. And I think someone reported that his lawyer wrote something on a pad in court and he looked over. And
that. I saw him reading in court, right?
He started reading it.
Yeah. Not even.
How does that work?
Yeah, McMonagle was sitting next to him and he wrote something on a pad. Cosby's sitting to his right and Cosby looks down, nods, writes something down in response. I reported all of this at the time in my people.com stories. It was just astonishing to me. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I wish that there had been, in that case, cameras allowed in the courtroom, because I really feel like people could have seen for themselves. And again, I think the podcast is sort of doing that. When you hear the women tell their stories at length, you can just hear them. You get to hear what the rest of us heard in court and hear all of that. And it tells you so much more than just, and the behavior was so outrageous by his attorneys in both trials, that I think that if there had been, like, the Anita Hill hearings were televised, and I think that's why Congress was so like, wow, like they were just every business as usual at Congress, those hearings. But as soon as the public saw it, they were just like, oh my God. And that was, I was waiting for these moments in this case and it just didn't happen because, right, you know, all of it was happening where only we could see it.
That's unfortunate because had it been open to the public, then all of that scrutiny would have probably contained what the defense was able to do. I know there's a lot of debate about whether or not there should be cameras in courtrooms. I just think it should be everyone or none. It shouldn't be like pick and choose, because if we are actually, I mean, these are supposed to be public hearings. They're not supposed to be hidden. And especially when everybody is interested and when it affects everybody in the whole country should be able to see them.
I agree. And unlike in the Nassar case, it was very powerful, I think, when all the victims could testify at his sentencing, even though they didn't testify in court. Well, in Pennsylvania, you can't do that. And in fact, so the only victims that were allowed to testify were Andrea, her parents, and her sister. So the victim advocate for the state held a press conference after so they could all give their victim impact statements. And again, it wasn't in the podcast. None of that's in the podcast, but it's in the book. And you see Sonny Wells there, who was at the event, who was 70 at the time, and 17-year-old virgin,
when Cosby drugged and raped her twice. I'll say rape because with her it was rape. And he had been like a friend of her mother's for 2 years prior to that. And she can't even say his name. She has to call him BC. And she stood there talking for 20 minutes, tears pouring down her face as she talked about how she's never been able to have a long-lasting romantic relationship because of what he did to her, and just sobbing as she talked. I mean, if people could have, and actually those are actually online, you could watch them somewhere, but they weren't allowed to testify in court. And it was, it's just gut-wrenching.
Well, thank you for giving them their voice back. This is something that really will help them in the long run. There's no way that they should have been treated the way they were treated by the system. And there's no reason for the statute of limitations in this case or any case like it. It's so anachronistic. It's so archaic. There's no reason for that to be the case in today's society when we're so informed about how few sexual assault and rape victims come forward and how few of them ever get justice. Nikki, thank you so much for coming. We are getting overwhelmed with information. You have an encyclopedic knowledge of this case and the history, and it's a 50-year-long history, and you've been fighting this fight for 15 years, and we're so happy to have had the opportunity to meet you and to work with you to get the word out and to help support the many, many known and unknown victims of Cosby, the serial sex offender rapist. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks so much for having me on. I just love being able to talk about the case with professionals like you guys, experts in your different fields, and just, I love your podcast, and I think that it puts such a substantive spin on everything true crime, and I'm just thrilled that you had me on.
Until next time, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203-866-4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 0247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.